Right now in America, nearly 90,000 men, women, and children are waiting for a kidney transplant. Every day, about 11 people die waiting for the match that could save them. Meanwhile, we perform about 28,000 kidney transplants a year, barely one in three of those who need one. For every person who gets a second chance, two keep waiting or worse. That's why when we talk about abdominal transplantation, the reality is simple, and for thousands, it's a race against time. Welcome to White Coast Real Talk. I'm Athar Van Ond.
And I'm Akshara Anand. We're excited to talk particularly about why the kidney is one of the most critical organs in abdominal transplantation and major diseases that lead to kidney failure, the importance of organ donation, and how surgeons treat and manage transplant rejection.
Today, we're honored to be joined by Dr. Jenny Pan, a clinical instructor at the Stanford School of Medicine and a key voice in abdominal transplantation. She works on the front lines of some of the most complex surgeries, guiding patients through moments where every decision matters.
Dr. Pan, thank you so much for joining today. How are you doing?
Well, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. This is very special for me because this is the first time I've done something like this. And I'm very happy to share something that I'm very passionate about, which is kidney transplantation.
That's amazing. We're really grateful for you to be here today. So first, some things about the kidneys, what everyone should know. Our kidneys filter a lot of blood nonstop, but most people don't even know what would happen if that stopped for even a few hours. What's the simplest way to explain what the kidneys do to keep someone alive and how they work?
So, the kidneys perform two basic functions. They primarily clean the blood and they maintain our fluid balance. So, one of the major functions of the kidney is to remove waste and toxins. And then the other one is to maintain our fluid balance so that we don't become too swollen and that the cardiac output is manageable. There's also some hormonal actions as well.
And what everyday habits, such as sports drinks, energy drinks, supplements, dehydration, how can those damage the kidneys over time?
I think one of the most important things to understand about the kidney, like many other self-care habits, is to avoid extremes. So, to avoid extremes of dehydration, avoid extremes of drinking too many energy drinks. And so, whilst I don't think it's necessary to abstain from energy drinks or sports drinks, I do think that it is important not to drink too much of it, as for instance, many energy drinks contain very high levels of caffeine, sugars, and other stimulants, which can actually cause temporary dehydration or increased blood pressure, both of which are harmful to the kidneys. Importantly, habits like smoking or vaping are also quite harmful. And I think, in terms of maintaining overall kidney health, avoiding those bad toxins is quite important as well.
Great. And so going to like end stage diseases, when a doctor says a patient has reached end stage kidney disease or end stage renal disease, what does that really mean and how does that affect the patient?
Functionally, end-stage renal disease or ESRD and end-stage kidney disease, ESKD, are referring to the same clinical entity. I have found that, when I was in medical school, everything was ESRD, ESRD, and it is now actually more common, I think, appropriate to refer to end-stage kidney disease as end-stage kidney disease versus end-stage renal disease. And this is sort of trend towards patient-centered language, firstly. And so, that's to address the difference in the nomenclature. Functionally, it means that end-stage kidney disease, the measurement that we use to define kidney function, the glomerular filtration rate, is less than 15. Notably, once the GFR is less than 20, patients can be referred to kidney transplantation. Although patients with such a low GFR are typically on dialysis at this point. And so, hopefully a patient hasn't reached this level of kidney disease without somebody taking care of them. And so they're already on some form of renal replacement therapy. But if somebody is a newly diagnosed patient with renal failure and they're coming in with a GFR of 20 or less, it's quite dangerous. Firstly, there can be a lot of electrolyte imbalances, such as high potassium, which can cause cardiac problems. There can be a lot of waste buildup, which leads to mental cloudiness, nausea, fatigue, and then also a lot of fluid overload, which leads to a lot of swelling. It can lead to heart failure as well.
And is it often that when one kidney stops, the other one stops working too?
It is, although, functionally it's difficult. We don't have tests to really determine if it's the left kidney or the right kidney. They oftentimes they work together, and so we consider kidney function as the summative whole of what both kidneys are contributing. Although some patients are born with only one kidney, or some people are born with two kidneys, but one is considerably smaller and less functional than the other one.
And so some people hear the dialysis as a treatment and imagine their life shutting down. Do you think that's more viable or transplants are more viable? And what's part of a treatment that you wish people knew more about that actually can be empowering and help them live better?
So I think when patients first receive a diagnosis of end-stage kidney disease and they're told that dialysis is in their near future, it's quite overwhelming because it is a major lifestyle change. There are many different forms of renal replacement therapy. So there's hemodialysis, which everybody is quite familiar with. You go to a dialysis center about 3 times a week, 3 to 4 hours each time. There is also peritoneal dialysis, and these patients have a catheter inserted in their abdomen and they're able to do dialysis at home every night and they hook themselves up to the machine. There are also some patients who are able to do hemodialysis at home, and so they're able to adjust their schedules. The biggest burden for the patients is certainly the cost of time in terms of lifestyle changes. And so if most of the patients have to go to a dialysis center for their dialysis, it's 3 to 4 hours a day, at least 3 times a week. That's quite a lot of time to be sitting there. And oftentimes, if they need to arrange transportation, and that can also be a barrier or a burden for many people. And then usually people don't feel really good after dialysis. They feel really tired. And so, people will feel kind of like they lose a day. And so 3 days out of the week, I mean, that's half the week. And so it can be quite overwhelming, I think, for people to first receive this diagnosis. I think, one way to help patients feel more empowered, and that this is not sort of a, dialysis is not kind of this very final treatment, is to consider it as a bridge to transplantation. So the purpose of kidney transplant is to liberate patients from dialysis to provide them with a functioning organ, and it can last for many decades. So anybody with a kidney function, a GFR of less than 20, can be referred for transplant evaluation.
Yeah, for sure. I know kidney dialysis is like a huge time commitment, both like time and also it's like a mental and physical strain on your body. And obviously, the end goal is kidney transplant, which should hopefully help and fix most problems. But PKD runs in families and can affect generations. How does it change the kidneys over time, and what early signs do families overlook?
The patients that I've taken care of who have polycystic kidney disease, firstly, by the time patients come to see me, they're already end-stage renal failure patients because I do kidney transplants. Although in taking their history, there are some patients who know about a family history of polycystic kidney disease and they've been actively managing it early on. And for other people, it's a new diagnosis later in life. So oftentimes, I blood pressure, which can start pretty insidiously at a young age and may appear in someone in their teens or their 20s, can be an early sign. High blood pressure is, it's not that symptomatic. And high blood pressure over many, many, many years can cause damage to the kidneys, even if you don't have polycystic kidney disease. But people who may have undiagnosed polycystic kidney disease, that could be an initial sign. Some blood in the urine, some discomfort around their flank. These polycystic kidneys start off with tiny, tiny microcysts, but the kidneys still function normally. And over time, the disease, as part of the disease, these cysts can enlarge and replace normal nephron mass with these large cystic structures, which don't have kidney tissue and are not functional. And so polycystic kidneys over time actually get bigger and heavier. which is the opposite of other more common types of kidney disease we think of, maybe from diabetes, where as the kidneys become less functional, they shrink and they get much smaller.
I see. And so other than that, those kinds of diseases, like I know people have hypertension and it silently destroys the kidneys. What's really happening behind the scenes for the kidneys?
Right. So I like how you described it. It silently destroys the kidneys. And there are actually many younger patients I've taken care of, people maybe who didn't have great access to healthcare, who are immigrants from different countries, and they show up in renal failure because of undiagnosed hypertension that they've had for many, many years. And high blood pressure, like I mentioned, unless it's so high it causes you to stroke, it's typically not that symptomatic. High blood pressure can actually cause physical injury to the kidney blood vessels because of the high pressure. It can lead to scarring, reducing the flow, and then setting off this vicious cycle of nephron loss. And so the nephron is the basic filtering unit of the kidney. It contains a glomerulus, which filters, and tubules, which reabsorb and secrete. Once these are lost, they're unable to regenerate. And high blood pressure physically damages this over time and it creates a lot of scarring. And so nephron mass slowly becomes scar tissue.
And I know that some people are born with kidney problems. What are the most common congenital kidney conditions that you treat?
So we already spoke about one, polycystic kidney disease. There are other congenital anomalies of the kidney and urinary tract. There's a whole group of them. For instance, renal agenesis. So some people are born with just one kidney. Some people are born with two, but one could be really, really small. There are also what we call obstructive uropathies, where the normal drainage of the kidney is blocked by a congenital problem. For instance, posterior urethral valves or ureteropelvic junction obstructions. These are all quite common, although, I do treat kidney transplant patients, and most of the diseases that we see are related to diseases of chronic illness.
I see. And among all the diseases we've heard about, some of them lead to kidney transplants. So could you please explain what really is kidney transplant? And many people don't realize that we can live with just one kidney. So how do you explain a living donation and why it's possible?
Like you mentioned, we just need one kidney to survive. And it is a great gift of nature that we have two kidneys. Living kidney donation is where we have donors come forward and they donate either to a loved one, a friend, or we even have non-directed donors, so-called altruistic donors, who just want to come forward and donate a kidney. There actually is a very interesting documentary on Netflix. I'm not sure if you guys have watched it. I have only started it, and I think it's called Confessions of a Good Samaritan. And I believe it is by a woman who I think is also a filmmaker, and she wanted to document her experience as an altruistic donor. And so we have this great gift of being born with healthy kidneys. One of them can be procured. So living donors who come forward, they have to go through a very extensive workup. We have to make sure that that our donors are healthy and that they can continue to lead a healthy life with only one kidney. And so if donors have maybe the beginnings of high blood pressure or pre-diabetes or a history of a lot of kidney stones, these are all things that may preclude them from donation. We also do a very thorough anatomy scan to take a look at their anatomy. Sometimes prospective donors will not have a suitable anatomy for donation. And so we have to make sure that, importantly, donors will be able to have a healthy life with just one kidney and that their anatomy is suitable. So, I think you have some questions later on about, these living donations versus deceased donations. I'll also sort of just go into it. In general, modern day transplantation, we have very good outcomes for kidney transplant, whether deceased or living. And deceased donation, of course, these are deceased donors who have either previously consented to have their organs donated, or a discussion has been made with their loved ones. I was taught that 1 year graft survival for living donation kidneys are greater than 98%, and for deceased donor kidneys is greater than 94%, which is excellent. One of the differences between living donor donations and the deceased is The living donations last longer, they're more high quality. And it's related to the fact that there's more optimal conditions when the living donor kidneys are procured. So firstly, these are from healthy donors. They're scheduled operations, hopefully during the evaluation of the potential living donors, we've ruled out any medical problems that would lead to issues with the kidney transplantation. And then the other thing is there's decreased amount of time that the kidneys aren't receiving blood because the recipient surgery is timed. And so oftentimes in some institutions, they can have two rooms where the donation operation is happening in one, and then the recipient is being prepared in the other room. And so the recipient's already ready. They already have exposure. And once the kidney has been procured from the donor, it's just ready to be implanted. I mean, that's very, very little cold time. In other institutions, for instance, at Stanford, we don't often get two rooms to do these. And so we have to do them sequentially. So we'll do the donor operation first and then go with the recipient operation. It adds a little bit of cold time, but it's quite negligible.
If there's a like deceased donor that has died recently, I know that there's like a specific amount of time where the organ is still viable. How fast do you guys have to be working, and what are the like what's the process? Can you walk us through the process of transplanting an organ in this time frame?
Yeah, so I think you're talking about more specifically deceased donor kidneys. And one of the very fortuitous things about kidney transplantation is that kidneys can tolerate a longer cold ischemia time than other organs. I was taught up to, 48 hours of cold ischemia time, although we do try to implant the kidneys, within about 24 hours, 24 to 35 hours is quite reasonable. So, the logistics of transplantation is quite interesting. There's an entire organizational body between the donor and anyone on the transplant team. So this includes the surgeons and the transplant nurses, et cetera. And this is to prevent any conflict of interest. And so there's an organization called the OPO, Organ Procurement Organization, and they are responsible for running the match list and taking care of the donor and running the organ allocation. And as a surgeon, we will receive an offer. And so what this means is that every transplant institution will have a long list of candidates, and the donor, there's a donor match, there's a organ allocation match that's run between the donor and all of the recipients in that service area. And if my recipient comes up as a match, so sequence 1, 2, something high up there, then I will receive the offer. We call them organ offers from the OPO, and it's a description of the donor. And from there, I will decide if I will accept this offer or not. And once the offer, once I've accepted the offer, then the OPO will set the time of organ donation. And as you can imagine, there's also other organs that are in play. So heart, lungs, liver. And so there's many, many different centers and teams that have to be contacted. And so the OPO takes care of that. From our end, we make sure that our recipient is ready, bring them in if we have to. And once the organ is procured, then we have a few options of getting it transported to us. So most frequently, organs are transported. We call it static cold storage, which means that the organ is perfused with preservation solution and then put on ice and shipped to us cold. We also have the options of putting kidneys on a pump. We like to pump DCG kidneys or kidneys that we may want to, that have more cold time. And if we want to do the operation later, for instance, we like to have the kidneys on a pump. And so that's how we will start to time the recipient operation.
And so regarding the actual surgery, can you kind of walk us through how that would work?
Yes, absolutely. So the donor kidney comes procured with its own artery, vein, and ureter, and it is attached to the patient in those three places. And that's usually how I explain it to my recipients. The blood supply of the kidney will come from the large artery and vein of the recipient, and the ureter of the kidney will be attached to the bladder, and the patient should be able to urinate normally. At Stanford, we also routinely leave a stent in their kidney transplant, and the stent is like a small plastic straw, and it looks like an S. It's got a curl on either end. One curl stays inside of the kidney, it goes through the ureter, and then the other end of the curl stays in the bladder. And you're not able to see this from the outside, but this allows the connection between the urine and the bladder to heal. And we take it out in clinic 3 weeks after surgery. The kidney is placed low in the pelvis. And so we do not remove native kidneys typically as a part of this operation. There are some exceptions. And so usually people with their first kidney transplant, they end up with a total of three kidneys because they still have their two native kidneys. People usually recover pretty well after surgery. Most patients go home after 3 days. There are some instances where we will remove the recipient, the kidney before doing the kidney transplantation. And actually, for adult kidney transplant patients, which is, these are the patients I take care of, it's usually the polycystic kidney patients. They oftentimes, sometimes these kidneys can be, 10 to 15 pounds each. And so there is literally not enough space to put in the kidney graft. And so we have the options of taking out the kidneys staged and in a nephrectomy operation before transplant or doing it at the time of transplant.
I know it's kind of crazy to think that some people can have three kidneys in their bodies. And I know that you mostly focus on like adults, but if it were a child having a transplant, how would three kidneys even fit within the body?
Oftentimes for pediatric patients, they will have the kidney on the same side removed before the
Okay.
implantation. And, for the pediatric patients, oftentimes the kidneys that they're receiving are adult kidneys. And so that's even larger compared to the child.
I see. And so regarding the recovery of this process, could you please explain like the recovery, how they go through it, and how long it really is?
Yeah, and so kidney transplantation is a major operation. We are still operating around the large artery and veins of the legs. But patients do quite well after surgery. Most of them go home after 3 days. While in the hospital, patients will have a Foley catheter, which is a catheter that goes in through the urethra. It completely drains the bladder. It allows us to have very good monitoring of urine output. And it also ensures that the bladder stays decompressed because we have a new connection there with the donor ureter. That catheter is removed before patients go home. Sometimes we leave a surgical drain in there, which is also removed before patients go home. In terms of outcomes, we just discuss with our patients sort of immediate graft function, which is the kidney starts to work immediately, or delayed graft function, which means that it can take the kidneys sometimes a little bit of time to wake up and be fully functional. And so I tell all of my patients, especially those getting deceased donor offers, about 30% of the time to expect delayed graft function, which means they may still need dialysis for 2 to 3 weeks before the kidney is fully functional. And so these are, this is all information that we're assessing for the with the patients before they leave. And by the time they leave the hospital, they need to be walking around comfortably off all IV pain medications and just taking oral pain medications. And at that point, we should have a good idea of whether or not the kidney is working as it should with immediate graft function or if it's delayed.
And so regarding the recovery, I'm sure that even in the process, major advancements in surgery can help speed up and make it more healthier and safer for the patients. Is there any big innovations right now that's happening, or will progress the field in, I guess, like 5 to 10 years?
There's a lot of research in kidney transplantation. There's, certainly many ways that outcomes can be improved. So I think one of the major clinical problems that we're always trying to solve as transplant surgeons is how to manage rejection or how to improve rejection. And so there are many new drugs now that can be used to treat rejection, but in terms of things that are on the horizon, there's a lot of research been done at Stanford by Dr. Stefan Busk, who's our surgical kidney and pancreas transplant director, and he's also one of my mentors. He's been working on this concept of tolerance for a long time, and so the idea of tolerance is to allow your body to accept the donated tissue of someone else with zero or very minimal immunosuppression. Immunosuppression is critical to accept the donated organ, but it can have side effects and it's not perfect. And so, at least at Stanford, one of the big clinical projects that we're always working on is to see how we can achieve tolerance in our patients. And this is research protocol driven. And the idea is in well-selected patients, so they already have pretty good immunologic matching between the donors and the recipient. They also at some point receive a bone marrow transplant. The recipient will receive a bone marrow transplant from the donor. And there's other protocols to see if this will induce tolerance. And so I think that's one of the more exciting things that we're working on.
This is perfect because we are just about to go into our section about rejection. How do you guys diagnose rejection? Is it like you wait and see until there are symptoms, or can you detect it quickly and earlier on?
So at its core, rejection is still a histologic diagnosis, meaning that it should still be made with a kidney biopsy and a pathologist. These days, we are able to detect problems with the kidney quite early before it even becomes symptomatic. And we monitor our patients, after they leave the hospital very closely. So we have our patients come into our clinic 2 times a week for the first 3 weeks. And every time they come in to see us in clinic, we're checking their labs. So in the first 3 to 4 weeks after surgery, we are checking the labs for a patient at least 2 times a week. And this is because there's still a lot of changes happening with the kidney during this time. But one of the most important numbers we will look at this is a serum creatinine, which is a number that should come down as renal function improves. Although it is also, it can be one of the, an increased creatinine can be one of the first signs of rejection. And so these days, most of our patients are getting treated for rejection before they become symptomatic because we are able to detect it so soon.
That's amazing. And so, if the first treatment doesn't work, what options do patients have next? And so, for anti-rejection medications, how long do they work, and why are they really essential for the patients?
So there's two basic types of rejection that we treat. More commonly, cell-mediated rejection, and secondly, antibody-mediated rejection. And so, this is all based on the different parts of the immune system and how it's interacting. So, cell-mediated rejection is needed by the T cells, and these T cells basically will recognize the kidney as foreign, and the T cells will become activated. They will secrete cytokines, and then cause a lot of injury. So, treatments for cell-mediated rejection are aimed at quote unquote freezing or getting rid of the problematic T cells. Steroids are the mainstay of therapy because it can block inflammatory mediators like IL-2, which can recruit and expand lymphocytes. And we can also give patients antibody treatments that deplete these T cells. Antibody-mediated rejection, this is when antibodies are involved. Oftentimes, the recipient has already developed something called a donor-specific antibody. These antibodies can bind to donor HLA molecules on endothelial cells. They can activate the complement cascade, resulting in endothelial injury. And basically, the blood supply to the nephrons is compromised. In antibody-mediated rejection, and obviously the way we can make this diagnosis is based on a biopsy. So if we don't have a biopsy, we would not be able to tell if it is cell-mediated or antibody-mediated. We will still give steroids in antibody-mediated rejection, but we will give more consideration to starting antibodies that will deplete B cells, which are actually the source of these antibodies. Many different types of antibodies now on the market aimed at blocking certain parts of the inflammatory cascade. There are also different modalities, such as plasmapheresis, which can remove circulating antibodies, and giving IV immunoglobulins, which can block antibody interaction. So, really, in a bad rejection, the way it's treated now is multimodal, using several different types of treatment.
And in the long run, what do you think is like the biggest setback or problem that a patient that has received a kidney transplant should watch out for?
Yeah, so, I always tell my patients that The easy part is a surgery. The surgical portion, it's a couple of hours. They're in the hospital for a few days. We monitor them for, 3 to 4 weeks by the surgical team to make sure there's no surgical complication. But then the rest of it's a lifelong commitment to taking care of this organ. I have seen patients who have been able to keep their kidneys working for over 30 years, which is incredible. And I think, it's in taking care of patients like this, and many of us do get into transplant because it can be so life-changing for so long. Oftentimes, these are, of course, patients who have a good immunologic match. They were fortunate enough to get a living donor kidney, but they also took really good care of their kidneys. This is, I think, the most important thing for patients to that I would like to tell them. In terms of preserving the longevity of their kidney, is that this is a lifelong commitment. There is a lot of excitement and anticipation in the buildup to getting the operation, especially for the patients getting deceased offers. They don't always know when they're going to get it, and they've been waiting for years. But I think, most of the work that goes unseen, that is the most important for maintaining the kidney. Is everything that's done after the kidney, in terms of taking their medications on time, checking in with their nephrologists, and our nephrology talk colleagues who are taking care of managing these patients for years.
For sure. I think it's really heartwarming and amazing that a patient can get so much better after a heart transplant. And I really think that's like the essence of medicine. And so, do you have any patient stories that really stuck with you throughout your career?
I have a lot, actually. One that comes to mind is a patient who had a heart transplant, actually. And so sometimes we will do multi-organ transplants. Sometimes we'll do heart transplant followed by a kidney transplant, or liver followed by a kidney transplant. The kidney transplant can be done right after surgery, or the patients can recover from the heart transplant and then wait a few months and then be listed for a solitary kidney transplant. There is one particular patient who comes to mind. She has a congenital heart problem that is genetic and inherited, and that bad gene was inherited by many members of her family, including her mother and many of her siblings. And many of her siblings had passed because of this heart problem, and she was able to get a heart transplant. And it was a very difficult operation, a very difficult recovery for her. She was in the hospital for many, many months. And unfortunately, sometimes as a result of heart disease and a heart transplant, that can also damage the kidneys, which is why she needed a kidney transplant. It is because of the primary heart problem. By the time I saw her, she had already recovered from her heart transplant and she was in much better shape. And we were able to take her off of dialysis with a good deceased donor offer. And for her, what makes her so memorable for me is that we've all had the experience of taking care of very, very sick patients, especially as trainees, and then we rotate off service and we don't know what happens to them, right? But then one thing that stuck out is in speaking with her and reviewing her chart, I could tell she was one of these patients who was very, very sick for a long time, in and out of the ICU, but she pulled through. And so, I think humans are a lot stronger than we give them credit for. And so she had pulled through after months in the hospital with this complicated course from her heart transplant. She was ready to get her kidney transplant. She was very excited. She had a lot of plans for what she wanted to do with her grandkids and so forth. And for myself, it will always remember her. I learned a lot from her. And, every time I'm kind of asked about my opinions of my job, I have to say it is an incredible privilege to be able to perform the service. It is a huge privilege to be able to be, firstly, a doctor, importantly, a transplant surgeon. It has taken a lot of sacrifice in terms of, my family support. I've had so many mentors and teachers. So it is a huge privilege to be able to do this job. And secondly, I always quote one of my mentors, which is, we can't do this job without our donors. In transplant, we have the opportunity to help two families, actually. We have our recipient, and then we have the families of our deceased donors. that we're able to help. Although we don't know who they are, there's a lot of ethical and issues involved in conflicts of interest. But although I don't know the family of my donors, I don't know my donors. I do think of them, and I'm grateful for them.
Well, that was super touching. And I feel like every episode where we get patient stories, it just keeps on getting more and better and just more touching. To end off today's episode, do you have any advice for incoming medical students or residents or anyone that's looking to get into your specific specialty?
So firstly, I think we are all here to make this world a better place. And medicine is a calling. It has to be something that you feel so compelled to do that you can't see yourself doing anything else. And so, transplant surgery, especially the training to get to this point is so difficult. It is not just personal sacrifice at this point, and I've been in training so long that, I had my daughter when I was finishing my general surgery residency at Stanford, and then later my son. And so I have the experience of going through surgical training, being pregnant, and then also the experience of going through my transplant fellowship with a very young infant. And it was a great sacrifice on the part of my parents to be able to help me with the childcare. This also happened in 2020, when the world was a very, very strange and unknown place. I think the most important thing I have to say is medicine is a calling, and do it because you feel compelled to. If you feel like you're pursuing medicine for someone else or for other reasons, it is going to be very, very difficult, and you'll probably be unhappy. I think there are many, many ways to make the world a better place and to help people that don't involve being a physician. But there's lots of ways to do that. But, truly, I think the person that has benefited the most in terms of my career pursuits as a physician is myself. Patients will have any number of doctors. There's many people who can do what I do. Although, having been in the pursuit of medicine, either in terms of the education or the training for so long, it has really forced me to grow a lot as a person and to really improve myself a lot in an accelerated way, where if I didn't have the pressures of being a doctor, I wouldn't have that kind of discomfort to push myself in that way. And I will never think it has been anything less than a privilege to do this job.
Dr. Pan, thank you so much for your time, your experience, and your dedication to the patients you serve.
Well, thank you guys so much for inviting me to do this podcast. It has been a very special experience for me. Thank you so much.
Thank you.